This spoiler-filled podcast is recorded live, unscripted, and intended for those over 18. Now prepare your ears for the audio stimulation they've been waiting for all day as we step into
the spoiler room.
So we're going to move right along to Paul's choice. Paul, what did you bring to the table tonight?
I picked The Exorcist 3, Legion.
Nice. Okay, and why don't you tell our viewers, listeners, a little bit about Exorcist 3, because I think it's a sequel that not many people are actually familiar with.
Probably not. I found it better than The Exorcist 2 for it being basically a more atmospheric kind of chiller thriller with a lot of religious icons thrown throughout, and it had a lot of tie-ins to the first film. In this film, we see Father Damien, Father Karras, I'm sorry, is basically possessed by the soul of this serial killer called the Gemini Killer, who is played in part by Brad Dourif from Chucky fame. And you find out that the master that's basically kind of the devil from the first film, he's upset with the Father Karras for helping out in the exorcist, in the exorcism. And he basically hatches this revenge plot to basically make everybody see the saintly priest as this kind of face of evil. And in this film, we see George C. Scott playing fabulously the role of Lieutenant Kinderman, who is a friend of the father. And it's a very interesting film, again, because it does what a lot of films probably do poorly nowadays, which is to create atmospheric horror versus actual straight-up jump scares. So, again, this is a very slow film. A lot of people that don't like the slow-burn type films probably won't enjoy this film as much as I did. But I found it a really very interesting character. And I love movies that, like, go back into the past and try to kind of honor what's already been out there by tying in stories, tying in the story, and then also kind of expanding on the story and giving a little bit of a new twist with the introduction of the Gemini Killer. I thought that was an interesting thing. And you still do get an exorcism in this film, because how can you have a film called The Exorcist without an exorcism, right?
So, we are Legion. Yeah, I remember seeing this film, and I mean, any sequel follow-up to the first one is not going to be... I mean, there's just... sorry.
That one.
would you not agree? You can't... There's some films, I'm sorry, no matter how good they were written, the requels, the sequel, whatever, nope. You're just not going to be able to capture that same magic again. The Exorcist, for me, has always been one of those films. And three, yeah, it is a darker, slow-burn film. Don, what'd you think of The Exorcist 3?
I liked it. Mostly because let's qualify that a little bit. I liked the story Legion that the movie was based on. Mm-hmm. You could that William Blatty wrote. You could tell the parts that he did that he wanted to be the story Legion, which was the story of the Gemini Killer and the police officer, George C. Scott's character, Kinderman. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You could tell that the parts that the producers kind of forced in there, the parts about the exorcism to tack it on to the Exorcist series, they felt forced. They simply did. Mm-hmm. The performances, love Brad Dourif. He is so wonderfully creepy. but Paul, you're absolutely right. The atmospheric horror in there is just wonderful. It's the tension is great. George C. Scott, I had read that George C. Scott actually really wanted and petitioned to be in this movie when it was just supposed to be Legion. And, yeah, they tacked on the extra scenes of the exorcism with the father mourning to a tune of $4 million just to put it, just to make sure it was part of the Exorcist series so that that name and that brand would be part of it, which, you know, is the weakest part of the film.
Which I still enjoyed.
And but this isn't the first time that we've had that, though, in a sequel that has actually, it's a book, you know, and they tack on it just so that it'll, you know, shoehorn it, use that story to shoehorn it into a franchise, you know, a franchise into a sequel. I mean, Die Hard 2 did that with the book 90 Minutes, and they basically took the book 90 Minutes and replaced, you know, put John McClane in it and made it a different, a different book. So, I mean, it has been done before. Not saying it's right. I'm saying it'd be interesting just to see what the Legion would have came out as. But it is something that has been done in the past.
That whole last sequence with in the cell with
fake lightning.
The fake lightning, the hole to hell, the Father Karras coming up crucified. That was, you know, with all the wonderful implied horror and tension and all the subtle things they had done, just to be that overt was disappointing.
Sure. Well, yeah. I mean, it was you could tell it was there were scenes that just didn't quite fit with the rest of the story, at least the feel of it. Scott, what about you? Your feelings with Exorcist 3?
I love William Peter Blatty, if you take the movies and the book, actually, this makes up the final chapter of his Faith trilogy. The book Legion, and then the movie Exorcist 3. First chapter being The Exorcist, second chapter being a wonderful movie, impossible to categorize movie from 1980 called The Ninth Configuration. If you guys ever have a chance to see this with a completely open mind, please do. It's one of the best films ever made, just like The Exorcist is. And yeah, you're absolutely right, Mark. Any film that's going to come follow The Exorcist is going to be wanting. This is better than Exorcist 2. I think it's a really good movie. It is, oh gosh, it is extremely problematic. Mm-hmm. Because, and a lot of that goes towards Morgan Creek, the production company behind it. Morgan Creek, you know, as good as they did with Young Guns 2 earlier in the show, they've always done really poorly by the Exorcist movies. And you saw that with Exorcist 4, which wound up being two movies, a controversy I was very, very, had a very, very small part of. And they've always had this difficulty of knowing exactly what to do with The Exorcist, with trying to make it into a big franchise, and it's just not like that. It's just not built for that. And the only person to ever come close to that was William Peter Blatty when he wrote the book Legion. it was a great book, and the movie has wonderful moments. The atmosphere is incredible. At the same time, you can see all the stuff this view added. You can see stuff that were even added to the atmospheric scenes where all of a sudden, for no reason, you'll hear growling on the soundtrack, or you'll hear like a jump scare chord, ba-bum, when nothing's going on. and you just know that, oh, yeah, they just took it from him in post, didn't they? It was originally called Legion. It was originally going to be more like the movie. Then they insisted it be called Exorcist 3 and then said, wait a minute, we have a movie called Exorcist 3 without any exorcists in it. And they said, like, yeah, it wasn't called Exorcist 3 until you insisted. And then they fixed it. It's a jumble, and it's a problematic movie. However, there is so much in this movie I love. Mm-hmm. George C. Scott's fantastic as Kinderman, taking over for the part Lee J. Cobb played in the original. George C. Scott's an actual friend to smart horror anyway. The Changeling, incredible movie. And I think he plays the part great. It's great to see Father Dyer, the character's Father Dyer, also played different by Ed Flanders this time. You see lots of things. I actually find the Brad Dourif parts, as much as I like Brad Dourif, I find them too showy.
Mm-hmm.
I find the monologues, which is basically all the character is, because he's always in the cell, are a bit too showy.
Mm-hmm.
All the little details they have, and little lines of dialogue, and the idea of, oh my god, this man who did the most noble sacrifice possible is being tortured for the sacrifice that he made. I mean, it's really something special. So it's one of those films that I like it. It could have been something incredible.
Sure.
And it's always a fascinating movie to me, and it's always so hard to sum up.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating film. It could have been incredible. As it stands, it is decent. And
sure.
The reason for anything that is decent in there is the genius of William Peter Blatty.
Hmm. And Cole, what about you? Anything to add at all for Exorcist 3 at all?
Yeah, I like it. Even as a young kid, I thought there were parts there that were odd and weird. Mm-hmm. And then as you get older and you begin to realize that movies aren't just movies, they're, especially part threes and fours and fives are, they're all products of a much bigger scheme. And you realize that Exorcist 3 was not originally Exorcist 3, it was this whole other thing. And
sure.
Jesus, every other Exorcist movie was, including mm-hmm. Part 4, which I saw Paul Schrader's version. Am I pronouncing his name right?
Yes.
I saw his version for the first time 2 years ago, which is fucking amazing. Mm-hmm. Holy shit. Dominion rocks.
I thought so, too.
But I think this movie is great. I mean, there's really creepy moments in there. Like the old lady voice making the confession about, what are we going to do to stop all of this baby? That's really good. And Brad Dourif went overboard. But even a lot, just those moments of trying to draw out this confession and then you realize it's tied to the first.
Sure.
It's a good movie, but... Mm-hmm. I do agree that there's shit in there that feels weird, like it didn't need to be there.
Yeah, and this feel a lot of bits of the Exorcist 3 feel like it had the producers involved a little bit too much in it to try to make it fit into the franchise. Glenn, any final thoughts real quick on Exorcist 3 that hasn't possibly already been said?
I'm mad as hell! And I'm not going to take these sequels anymore.
Nice.
Yeah, it was... I think not calling it Exorcist 3...
would have helped.
Better for it.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think it was an awful movie. I think it was an average movie, which I think when you look at the fact that... you have Brad Dourif and you have George C. Scott. That's kind of a waste
mm-hmm.
when you've got some really good acting talent and you just make a mediocre film.
Yeah, and it's not the first time Hollywood has done that either, especially in sequels where they just are possibly adding some people in for drawing people in, not so much if the person was
fitting. Yeah, that's definitely a Hollywood thing. I mean, taking really talented actors and turning them into complete mannequin squiggles.
Jorge.
Yeah.
So, Exorcist 3, an interesting entry into the franchise. It would have been better off, I think, and more well-received by itself. But any of the sequels for The Exorcist, I think... didn't need to be. The Exorcist film, if you watch the way that story and that whole film plays out, nothing in that film screams, wow, I think this needs a sequel.
nothing. It was a very intimate. It's true. It's a very intimate story. It's a very personal story about faith and everything like that. And it didn't deserve. Nobody thought it needed a sequel except the movie studio that said, "Holy crap, this is one of the biggest hits ever." That's the only reason it had a sequel. Every single Exorcist film, even the second one, which is so bad, every single one of them has a really interesting spin to it. It's like where you actually look at it and say, now that's kind of actually an interesting way to go. Now, how they pull it off in any of these sequels has almost uniformly across the board been a problem. But, you know, again, why they do it. So.
Right. Yeah, it's exactly why they do it. And, this comes back from a time, though, the 90s, they're still trying to feel out how to do sequels. I guess that, you know, while I complain, oh my God, they're actually green light all three of these films before the first film is ever even hitting the box office nowadays. Now I realize, though, you know, that plan actually works a little better because they can at least write the stories so that they're coherent. You know, when they made The Exorcist, I don't think anybody making The Exorcist expected it to get to three, let alone two, four movies.
One of the original executives at Warner Brothers that they showed the first Exorcist to thought the film was so obscene that they should just shelve it forever.
Yeah. Right? So, yeah. So some of these sequels, they were forced because suddenly they realized that they had a hit and they were trying to cash in on the name, a la Troll 2, when these films really didn't need a sequel or ask for a sequel, or they had a story that would have been better as an original, but they decided, no, let's make it a sequel. That way we get that name recognition. So
yeah. Your movie that you're going to do later is like that, too.
Yeah. If we get to mine. Interesting choice there, Paul. I'm glad you brought it up because that was always an interesting film to me, the way they handled that movie, that it is a slow burn, atmospheric, but then you get these bits that just don't quite fit. And now, 25 years later, we know exactly why. So let's move on to Scotty D's choice for the evening here. I appreciate everyone hanging in here on this episode tonight. Scott, why don't you tell us which film you brought?
My film is Sorority House Massacre 2, and the good news about this one is that it was always supposed to be crap. so that if you find yourself watching it and saying, oh, the acting, oh, the sets, oh, the plot, oh, exactly, it's fine.
tell our listeners a bit about that film.
Well, the good news is you don't have to, is that if you've seen the original Sorority House Massacre, good, it's a decent slasher film, but it has nothing to do with this one, don't worry about it. However, this film does use ample stock footage from Slumber Party Massacre, oddly enough. What you have here is that four sorority sisters. Five, okay. You see, he can count better than I can. I suck at math.
He's busy staring at other things.
I count 10! Anyway, these five sorority sisters find a new place where they can have their sorority house, and there's personally five people in the whole sorority. And they find out when they get there, they're going to clean the place up that night, but there's no power, there's barely any furniture, there's nothing there until morning, so it's really bare bones. And they find out why they got the place so cheap, the woman says, because this is where this awful serial killer, Hochstetter, killed his entire family several years ago, to which one of the sorority sisters very poetically answers, "Ah, fuck." Which would be my exact response. Later on, they start to get ready for the night, which means you get lots of shower scenes and scenes of them changing into lingerie. And one of
you
them
know, because that's how we all dressed back in the 90s.
That's how everything it has to happen, has to be. They shower complete with squeaky noises when they're rubbing their private parts in the shower.
Yes.
And then they just one of them gets the brilliant idea of, "Hey, let's play with this Ouija board and see if we can summon the spirit." And they get scared, they decide not to. But then the murders start happening. The sorority sisters start getting killed off by this person in a hoodie wielding a hook. Now, could it be the ultra creepy guy across the street, Orville Ketchum, or is Hochstetter back from the grave? This movie is a very cheesy movie done by Jim Wynorski for Roger Corman. It was actually shot back-to-back with a movie called Hard to Die, and they used the exact same crew and cast and practically the same script and shot this other movie. The only difference between the two movies is this is more of a slasher film, and Hard to Die, not to be confused with Die Hard, is more of an action film but still involves demonic spirits.
And Orville Ketchum.
Yeah, and Orville Ketchum is in both. In fact, Orville Ketchum, that character pops up once again in Hard to Die, and the endings of both films are amazing. But you can imagine that the ending to Hard to Die might even be more hilarious, because Orville Ketchum finds love. You know that guy gets excited, and you and him and his lady friend are going to be doing stuff. Yeah. Freaky stuff. I'm talking butt stuff. But no, this is a great film. It's got so many great screen queens in it. Robin Harris, Melissa Moore is in it. Ex-adult star Barbie is in there under an assumed name. Also, you have Tony Naples. The late adult star Savannah is in there. It's basically this film that is absolutely exactly what it's supposed to be. It was originally called Sorority House Massacre 2, Nighty Nightmare. Mm-hmm. And it's advertised as, yeah, it's girls in lingerie trying to escape a demonic spirit wielding a metal hook, and there's lots of exploitation elements of sex, violence, and really cheesy, corny, campy dialogue. It is exactly what it pretends to be. And for that reason, I really dig, I think, Sorority House Massacre 2. I will say this, that from when I got the movie, how I got this movie was that I was attending a program for students. I'm visually impaired, so you can always take that into account when you disagree with the movies that I like. Like, well, you can't even see it. I'm visually impaired, and I was at this time I was a teenager, and I was taking part in this summer program that taught you how to live on a college campus if you were visually impaired. So I was actually staying at this college campus for a few weeks with a number of other people. We were at this college campus where nothing was quite working yet, and I had gone down to the drugstore and found this movie. And everybody else was supposed to be in the main sitting room watching a movie, and it was like some like PG-rated movie that, you know, so the parents won't get too excited, because I mean, which I don't understand, because we were all like at least like 16 and stuff at this point. But no one went down to that. Everybody was jammed in my little dorm room.
you corrupted more
looking you. Around at this movie, and everybody was just howling at this movie, and you were supposed to. It wasn't being mean-spirited to laugh at this movie at all. It wanted you to laugh at it. You were laughing with it. So it's a fun movie that you can have a good time with, and it's over and done in 77 minutes.
Yeah, it moves along nicely, and it's got Wynorski's name on it, so if you're not familiar with him by then, you see that name, you know exactly what you're in for. Dawn ended up was watching this, and she was texting me while I was watching it as well. And Don, why don't you give a few of your thoughts with Sorority House Massacre 2 setting the women's movement back about 80 years?
No, just kidding. Wow. So I like Scott, I thought it was a whole lot of fun.
Sure.
You'd mentioned, Scott, the footage, the archive footage from Slumber Party Massacre. Mm-hmm. Half hour into the film, I thought I was watching the wrong film. I was absolutely convinced I was watching the wrong film, because not only was it the archive footage from Slumber Party Massacre, but they also had newspapers. They were pulling out newspapers talking about the Slumber Party Massacre. So I'm like, whoa. So for I'd say a good half hour, 40 minutes, I was convinced that this was a sequel. Some sort of hidden or subliminal sequel to Slumber Party Massacre. Until I, you know, remembered, oh, wait, the bad guy's name is something else.
Yeah, exactly, okay.
Yeah, so, yeah, I was pretty confused for a little bit. But, yeah, there was, you know, 20 minutes in, there's boobs, and the boobs never went away. They were just decorated differently. because, you know, back in the 90s, women didn't have any other option but to wear, you know, thong negligees.
Around each other.
Each other, yes. Yeah. Because, you know, that was the rule. And then we all had to follow it or be banished.
In the 90s.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Movies have taught me it's that women only wear sexy lingerie, always wear sexy lingerie around each other, and when you're in the shower, it takes 48 minutes to wash your boobs. that's what these movies have taught me.
And women never wash their hair.
No.
Yeah, they never did they?
Much like the Brady Bunch never went to the bathroom, women in the 80s slasher film never washed their hair.
Yep.
But you would say it is fun, though. It's fun 80s cheese.
Very, very much fun.
In 1990, which is funny because you thought this type of film may have been going away, but here Wynorski is saying, oh, no, we still got plenty of this that we can make yet here in 1990.
I actually did have the DVD of this, and I could not find it anywhere. It was killing me that I had to watch it, but it is available on... Normally I'm not a advocate for this, but the movie has been long out of print with no signs of it coming out again in sight, so that the whole movie is available on YouTube.
Yes, so. Yes it is. And this film is... I watched it too, and I chuckled. I chuckled verily at just... I'm like, yeah, this is a Wynorski film, and one of the things I will say about it is the film does not feel like a film from 1990. It definitely feels like a film that was ripped from the middle early 80s exploitation horror. So in that sense, he did accomplish something as making it feel like a, you know, direct sequel, though it really had absolutely nothing to do with the first one.
No, actually, the first one was slightly more progressive than this one.
Yes, it was. The female director of that one had worked on Slumber Party Massacre, didn't she? Or there was some controversy there, I thought.
Let me see. Well, see, one of the things, and this is the difference between the Sorority House Massacre and two, and the all the other, and the first Sorority House Massacre, and all the other Slumber Party Massacres, is that Roger Corman, in trying to combat attacks that he was merely sexist and misogynist and trying to pull women back, he actually hired a lot of women to do these movies. It goes all the way back to his student nurse films, even. And so Amy Holden Jones, Rita Mae Brown, they were all involved with the Slumber Party Massacre. Then all the Slumber Party Massacre sequels were directed by women. The original Sorority House Massacre was directed by a woman. The reason this wasn't, and I don't even know if it was originally supposed to be a Sorority House Massacre film or not, but is just because it has such an unmistakably Wynorski touch. I mean, there's basically, if you saw this movie, you'd say, one of four people directed this movie. It was either Jim Wynorski, Fred Olen Ray, Richard Gavai, or David Dakota. And my money's on Wynorski. and that's basically, you know, why it's like that. Sure. But Corman always did that. He always put when if he there was something that was inherently exploitive, and, you know, let's face it, he There was a lot that was. It's called exploitation cinema. He always put women in charge of stuff. Not so much in this one. Although, you know what? If you love old Scream Queens and stuff, this is great. You get to see, you know, Melissa Moore. You get to see Tony Naples. A couple former adult actresses do walk-ons and stuff like that. And you know, you get this nice cast, and then if that's not enough, Orville Ketchum, man, the dude is Orville Ketchum.
Yeah, just Google Orville Ketchum, you'll see the picture, and you will never forget that face. So I'm glad you brought that up.
He's the poor man's wine horse. Ron Jeremy.
Great picks from everybody tonight. I appreciate that. I know the episode's going a little long tonight, and I'm glad you mentioned Sorority House Massacre 2, Scott, because out of the others that we had here, those were wide releases, and then you had Sorority House Massacre 2, which wasn't a wide release. That was
and Troll 2 wasn't either, to be fair.
No, and Troll 2, that's true. Troll 2 wasn't either. So thank you, Glenn, for bringing that one as well, because as much as we had the 15 wide release sequels, we had even more direct-to-video sequels out there. And Troll 2 and Sorority House Massacre were just a few of those. And tonight, I'll bring mine real quick. We won't keep you too much longer. But mine tonight I picked because I am such a fan of the original film. And I just love the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre so much. And then 2 came out, and that one was just a lot of fun. It just was letting loose and everything. And then they came out with Leatherface, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, which I'm going to say right now, and I think everybody here will agree, had probably one of the best early examples of how to do a teaser trailer in film for a horror film. I mean, the teaser trailer was awesome. I remember seeing it in the theater, the woods, he had the voiceover, and he had the big bulky guy standing on the lake of this pond, you're like, oh, what's this about? And then all of a sudden, the chainsaw comes out like Excalibur, the Lady of the Lake, throwing the chainsaw to Leatherface, and he turns around and it's right. Leatherface. I loved that teaser. That teaser made me so excited for the film, and then I saw the film, and I was like, what did I watch? Is this a requel? What's going on here with Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3? Folks, it felt like they were trying to kind of go back to the feel of the original, where we have some text scroll in the beginning that tells us the events, unfortunately, of what happened after the first one, which one of the Sawyer families were gassed, and the original survivor of the first one, the only survivor of the group of teens from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, died in a mental hospital. So right there, that felt like the Alien 3 death of Newt and
Hicks.
Yeah. For me, right off the bat, you get that to where you're like, oh, okay.
Well, fuck you, movie.
She went through all that, and she dies in a mental hospital. That's fantastic. Thank you very much. So then we get a couple that seems like they're ripped out of Children from the Corn, driving in a down a road that looked like it was a scene ripped from Children of the Corn. and they're a couple, and they're on the Texas country road, and they're on the rocks, if you will. And the one girl, she hits armadillo. They can't hit armadillo. Anyway. It's trying to hit the same beats as the original, down to they find a mass grave, whereas in the original you had them grave robbers and you had them taking pictures of skulls and stuff, and you get that here. And eventually they cross paths with some more members of the Sawyer family who have taken in Junior, who is our Leatherface, or supposed to be the Leatherface from the first one, though I think he's a poor rendition of the original Leatherface. And so we meet the Sawyer family made up of, yes, folks, we heard his name once already tonight. You'll hear it again. Viggo Mortensen.
Yay.
Is in here as the attractive one of the Sawyer family playing the suave cowboy. And the couple are joined, they cross paths also with this survivalist, who the three of them try to survive the Sawyer family in Leatherface, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3. Oh, wow. You know, I hadn't watched this film in a long time, and after watching it again, there are bits and pieces of this film that I enjoy, and you can see where they were trying to go with it. I just think they really go about it wrong. This is an example of a studio, much like the way Troll 2 was using its name for recognition, and a couple of the other sequels tonight just using the name for recognition. This one also, I think, it had hints of the original, but everything was a little too over the top. I mean, the Sawyer family in the original they were crazy as fuck, but they didn't have, I mean, in this one, they have all these physical issues, and they seem like freak show rejects. Paul, how about you with this Leatherface film? It definitely a poorer sequel to the first two, isn't it?
I would agree. Believe it or not, I didn't watch the first one until much later. Mm-hmm. In life. So as far as I knew, Texas Chainsaw Massacre was the second movie. Oh, sure. I know, right? This movie kind of really took it out in a different direction that I wasn't expecting either. And I don't know. I liked the characters. I liked some of the actors in there. Mm-hmm. But like you said, this isn't Leatherface to me. I mean, it didn't seem like him.
Well, this was a clunky movie. I mean, yeah. if we've mentioned the term, and it's true with this one, it almost felt like this film wasn't quite sure which way it wanted to go. Do we want to go completely sicko like the first one, or do we want to make it more mainstream? Well, let's try both, and it doesn't quite work. Cole, have you seen Leatherface?
I would say probably bordering like 100, 200 times. I think it's a great film, man. I mean, I really do. Here's the thing. I exist in a world where I saw this film made. Like, I was young. I had a subscription to Fangoria. Fangoria in those days would show up in your mailbox in a body bag. I'm talking like a black, shiny body bag. That's how Fangoria would show up in your mailbox, man. It was a black bag, and you would open it up, and you would take out your Fangoria. And Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3 was huge at the time. David Chow was writing it. He, you know, was also in the same studio at the time trying to sort out Nightmare on Elm Street 5, apparently, because his name is in those credits as well. But this movie is very much a New Line movie in that they were looking to get it out to as many different places as possible. You know, Robert Shea didn't want to struggle at that point.
Sure.
Robert Shea wanted to make it. And lots of people blame the MPAA for Leatherface, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, it wasn't. That movie was hacked up before it even went to the MPAA because Robert Shea wanted to very much secure his foreign distribution rights. Mm-hmm. And this is true. I have an interview with the composer Jim Manzi, who unfortunately had to go in and sit and watch this movie with Robert Shea and the director, Jeff Burr. Poor Jeff Burr. You know, I mean, this is the guy who directed, like, Pumpkinhead 2. I think he also directed, like, Leprechaun 12. Poor Jeff Burr. Jesus. This movie is just it's a doomed production from the get-go. You've got a bunch of talented people trying to save an idea, which is they have no script. They don't have a script that work. Mm-hmm. I mean, somebody in this whole criticism mentioned it. They have no idea. Where's the script? Well, Leatherface died in part two. How do we build on it? Well, let's just ignore that. Caroline Williams has a cameo. You know, the most interesting character possibly in the franchise, shows up for, what, 5 seconds?
I think so, yeah.
Or, you know, the woman who defeated Leatherface in part two. It's just a bad film. I mean, I enjoy it. I think it's fine, but, you know, what are you going to do with the Chainsaw franchise after the first? Maybe, you know.
Well, again, and again, it falls in the line with many of these others where they hadn't really planned on a sequel. So when you're doing one, you know, and especially after two, which they just had fun with, you know, if the Breakfast Club poster, as we mentioned before in other previous episodes, the Breakfast Club, you know, replication of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre characters, if that isn't any indication of what TCM2 was, you're missing the point. And three, yeah, I don't know. There's bits that I enjoy about this. Don, what about you with Leatherface? Have you seen this?
I thought I had seen this movie, and I hadn't. Because, oh, okay.
It's a blur.
And I didn't realize I hadn't seen it until I started trying to refresh my memory, visiting the clips that are posted in various places online. But the trailer was so memorable. And watching the video clips, I'm sitting there thinking, oh my God, I've not seen this. I feel terrible.
No, that's okay.
And then there's the video, the one video clip that just had me floored going, how can they possibly justify having a chainsaw running underwater?
Mm. One of the many, many...
And it doesn't stop either.
It doesn't stop. Well, it's a special chainsaw. Wouldn't you say, Glenn, that this film is a special chainsaw?
Special is the appropriate word here.
Yeah, definitely special.
I mean, isn't this someone really at a studio trying to mainstream a film that shouldn't be mainstreamed? Uh-huh. I mean, the story-wise, wouldn't you say, Glenn?
The whole... To me, it feels like an unnecessary film because it doesn't add anything new at all from one or two. Well, it doesn't add anything from two, really, and it feels like it doesn't have the gritty edge or, you know, the grittiness of the original at all.
Right.
It feels like it was made to set up the next movie.
Yeah, you know, and they got Grandpa in here, which made no sense, who's dead. I mean, he kind of was on his last legs in the other films, but here he's dead. He's a corpse, Paul. Yet they still have Grandpa.
Grandpa was like furniture. So
Grandpa was like furniture. Well, yeah, I wanted to get your. They bring Grandpa back. Come on.
Oh my God. Yes. I mean, well, again, that's them trying to tie it in. I appreciate movies that do that. I'm probably one of the worst people when it comes to that kind of thing. I enjoy that sort of stuff in sequels where they bring back characters from the past and stuff like that. And I know they do it because they need to do it, and it's kind of thrust upon us. But I enjoy them attempting to do that. It gives me that tie that I need.
Yeah. I don't know, though, with this one, you know, completely ignoring two. Scott, your feelings with this third film?
When I first saw this movie, I first saw it when it hit VHS back in the day.
Woot.
And I think I saw this with my friends. I don't know if we were having some sort of like a party or whatever, or sleepover, or what the deal was. I don't know what it was. I don't know how old I was or whatever happened. But when I first saw it, I remember seeing it with a group of people, and I think we all just thought it was just terrible. And I hadn't seen it since then until tonight. I said I better refresh my memory on this movie, and I'm just not looking forward to it. I didn't have very huge memories from it. I remembered that Mother spoke with a voice box.
Mm-hmm.
I remembered laughing back in the day at the great little gag with the speak and spell, where it shows a person and he keeps on Leatherface, what is this? And Leatherface keeps on typing in F-O-O-D, and he's really frustrated when he's being told he's wrong. It's the only things I could remember about the movie. So I says, well, I better refresh my memory, otherwise I can't say anything. And So I had a couple hours to kill. I refreshed my memory on it, and honestly, when I saw it this time, I didn't hate it, which was a huge surprise for me. Now, don't get me wrong, it's not a great movie by any stretch.
Right.
And there is no horror film, whether it's part of this franchise or outside of it, that has ever captured what Texas Chainsaw Massacre accomplished. I will say that as its own little B horror film, okay, yeah, it's a decent, enjoyable B horror film. It's got certain problems. I think that, for instance, in the characters, for instance, they try to bring in a new family characters, which is fine. Chainsaw 2 did that when they brought in Bill Moseley as Chop Top, you know. This one tries to bring in Viggo Mortensen as Tex. They got Tinker. I'm looking at these people.
Alfredo
is the one I couldn't freaking stand. And Tom Everett has some good credits elsewhere in his repertoire. I think he played this completely wrong. He played this completely comedic, almost just like Bill Moseley did. But here's the thing is that whereas you were talking about you didn't know if the film should be a mainstream or gory, I didn't think this film knew if it should be serious or satirical.
Right.
And that was a problem because you have the original, which is very serious, and then you have the second, which is very satirical and over the top. And you have this one that's just kind of in between. And because of that, it doesn't really resonate either way. It kind of just kind of sits there and it's like, okay, I see what they had here. But it kind of like thuds on the ground, like, oh, okay, you know, there's decent parts to it. Like, I still think some of these chase scenes are good. I think having it happened in like this nighttime wooded area, which Joe Bob will tell you is not Texas. He got really pissed off. Joe Bob first got really pissed off at this movie. If you haven't seen the YouTube clip that one of our colleagues posted a few months ago. I think that was a nice change of pace and stuff. There's decent changes of pace here, but at the same time, I feel like it's just there. And then Jeff Burr, as Cole said, poor Jeff Burr, was just okay. This is what the producers want, which is what he has been put in that position before and afterwards. This guy,
yeah, man.
I remember reading an interview with a guy. I can't remember where it was. It might have been Shock Cinema. But it was somewhere, I don't know, some magazine. And he talked about some of the films that he was really proud of and stuff like that. I think this was right around the time of his World War II themed film, looking in the IMDb, Straight Into Darkness. Right around the time that came out, he was really proud of that movie. And he had to talk about his entire filmography. And there's a lot of numerals in that filmography. And he had to say, like, look, every time I got a sequel, Stepfather 2, Chainsaw 3, Pumpkinhead 2, Puppet Master 4 and 5, he did all of those movies. And he said, the assignment was whatever the producer told you to do. And he said that, you know, they didn't turn out the way he wanted, but he turned in what he was supposed to turn in. And he says, because of that, a lot of people get really pissed off at you. And, okay, maybe kind of. He's kind of trying to look for an out there, but I kind of sympathize with him a little bit. Yeah. It's not a great movie, but I was surprised that I didn't hate it as much as I used to. I think all the text. I think that this is holds up much better than say like the one with McConaughey and Zellweger.
Oh, yes. Don't even bring up.
And it's way better than Texas Chainsaw 3D.
People mention Next Generation, and I can't even think of that. I have many opinions about that film, but for this one, revisiting it after so long, there were bits and pieces I did enjoy. I enjoyed the little girl. I enjoyed, and this is what was frustrating, I enjoyed the part where they had a survivor, another girl who had survived Leatherface, and she lived out in the woods, and she was actually helping our heroes out. I loved that angle, because that girl had just gone crazy. You know, she mentions about eating a fucking rat raw, you know. I mean, she was a really great character, and then she goes out in the most worst, just lame way. I'm like, wait, she survived this long and now all of a sudden, eh. Meanwhile, we have our survivalist guy who gets in a fight with Leatherface in the water with the chainsaw still running in the water, which I didn't realize was quite possible, but by God, this chainsaw blade goes back and forth, and our hero, our female hero who's been strong up until this point, is suddenly standing on the shore going, go Flash, go! Rather than going up and, hitting Leatherface or doing something, she's been strong up until this one point in the film where they didn't want her to be strong anymore, and that frustrated me. And then at the end, you can tell I had problems with this ending, because at the end then, okay, she survived, and then we find out survivalist guy who got a chainsaw to the head still survived, and survives a second clubbing by a sledgehammer.
Because he's a survivor. Didn't you learn anything from Destiny's Child, Mark?
Yeah. Thanks, Scott. I mean, I totally, musical reference there. Yes. I totally agree that this film felt like it was trying to be one of those sequels that was a little bit, not quite mean-spirited, but trying to be satirical, poking a little wink nudge from the first one, but at the same time also trying to be serious, and it just doesn't work. And that's why I wanted to kind of bring it, because that's why I said with these sequels, not necessarily your favorite, just ones you wanted to talk about, because this is the 1990s. This is when the sequel movement is in full swing, if you haven't been able to tell with what we've been talking about tonight, and it's kind of why I wanted to do it, because from here on out, it's sequel city, and now we have a sequel culture of films to where we almost get more sequels than original films, and a lot of these sequels don't need to be made. And I think some of the examples tonight you've heard are prime examples of that, of studios suddenly realizing these one-off films are making money and are popular, so we got to cash in on that name. And in the end, they come up with a film that is nowhere near the original, which you can't expect that, but they're just not good films. They're not horrible films, but they're not good films either, and they would have probably been better off on their own in many of these cases. Not all these films, but some of them would have really just been better off on their own. So I know we went long tonight, but I appreciate everybody hanging in there. Why don't we go down real quick, and we'll have everybody here in the Spoiler Room crew tell you where you can find them when they're not being kind and showing up on the show. Cole, why don't you start?
Hello, you can find me on Facebook at Shadows and Lovers Productions, or Horror, R-O-A-R, or Cole Meredith. If you want to chat movies, you're always here on the Spoiler Room. Thanks for having me, Mark.
You bet. Thanks for showing up, Cole. And Dawn, how about you?
You can find me at intheaudience.net.
Fantastic. Glenn, go.
YouTube, Naked Hobo Productions, B-Movie Bunker, and same on Facebook, or follow me on Twitter at Naked Hobo.
Fantastic. Paul?
Facebook, Twitter, and WordPress at Forsaken Film Reviews.
Scotty D.
All right. You can catch me at movieocrity.com. Has not been updated for a while. I'm hoping it will in the next couple months. Working on some new stuff, including new episodes of my web series, Movieocrity, which you can catch at vimeo.com/channels/movieocrity. If you liked me talking about exploitation films like Sorority House Massacre 2, imagine that, but with pictures.
Well put. And yes, as always, folks, you can find links to all these wonderful people's stuff that they do on the specialmarkproductions.com homepage. That's where you can find our Spoiler Room archive, where we have all of our other episodes. This is number 68, if you can believe it. I hope you've enjoyed this 25th anniversary series that we've been doing. We've got one more, and then we're going next year, going to be doing 40th anniversary films, and you can have a say of what films we are going to review next year. Go to specialmarkproductions.com. There's a link at the top that's called the 4OOH special voting. Click on that and please vote. You got to make all your choices at once because you can't come back and change your mind. And vote, please. Polls will be open till December 13th, and those will be the films that we do for our 40th anniversary special that's coming up in 2016. But we got a lot of great stuff yet here on the Spoiler Room. Check it out. Check out my own stuff. That's also at specialmarkproductions.com if you're at all curious. We appreciate you listening in and hope you've enjoyed the Spoiler Room, because here the conversation is fresh, but we do spoil the movies.